Hi, I'm Carmen LaBerge. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Hello, friends. Welcome to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. Today is Monday, November the 19th, 2018. I remind you of that because lots of folks listen to this now via a podcast. And so if I don't tell them what day it is, then they spend at least some time wondering if I'm actually up to speed on the headline news of the day or whether or not I have completely lost track of time. So thank you for joining me here on Connecting Faith. However you're listening, via the Faith Radio Network or maybe online streaming at myfaithradio.com. Maybe you are listening to this via podcast after the fact. In any case, we are just really glad that you are here with us today. Hey, we have a really wonderful, I mean, it's true every week. Every week we have a great lineup of opportunities to talk about things here on Connecting Faith, but I'm particularly excited about this week. So today we're going to talk with Ed Stetzer and Bruce Ashford, both of whom have written really important books about, how to actually engage the conversations of our day in ways that honor Jesus. So I want to share that with you today. And then tomorrow we're going to talk again about socialism. And really what we're going to talk about is redemptive and redeemed capitalism. So my guest will be Gordon Conwell Seminary Professor Kenneth Barnes. And we're going to talk about redeeming capitalism in an age when socialism seems to be taking new root. And then as a warm-up to Thanksgiving on Wednesday, we're going to talk to Will Graham, Billy Graham's grandson, who has written a devotional book called Redeemed, Devotions for the Longing Soul. But my conversation with Will is also going to just be some personal stories about his granddaddy and his own heart for evangelism. And then I'm also on Wednesday going to be sharing with you my mother's signature Thanksgiving dressing recipe, which if you don't have a recipe yet, this is one you'll want to use. Thursday, which is Thanksgiving Day, my guest is going to be Kathy Lee Gifford. She and I are going to talk about Thanksgiving. We're going to talk about family and traditions and faith. And we're also going to talk about her new book, which is a children's book entitled The Gift That I Can Give. And then rounding out the week on Black Friday, I'm going to be talking with Professor Christopher Yuan. He has a new book entitled Holy Sexuality in the Gospel. And you're going to say to yourself, wow, that seems like a deep subject for the last day of Thanksgiving week. It is, but sex is holy and the gospel is real, and it's time we talk about both of them and the intersection of the two. So it'll be the day after Thanksgiving, and I will also be talking about what to do with our leftovers. So there you have it. That is the week in preview here on Connecting Faith. And so let's jump off here with some headlines from today. Yesterday was the anniversary of the Jonestown massacre. More than 900 people took their own lives at the leadership of a person who understood himself to be the reincarnation of both Jesus Christ and Lenin. And if you remember that period of history, we're talking about 1978, and if you remember all that was going on, those who joined this movement really thought that humanity was progressing toward some sort of utopia, and in reality, that doesn't happen. And so, when we look back, there are those who survived the massacre. They offered their reflections yesterday in many places. People talked about rebuilding their lives. Journalists talked about their experiences. And so I just really encourage you to remind yourself of who Jim Jones was, what that story was all about, the reality of mass suicide and the power of false religion and corporate delusion. And I encourage you to do that because, you know, frankly, there's a lot of contemporary examples of false prophets and people hawking false religion. And there are pretty good examples today of what I would describe as corporate or collective delusion. People, massive numbers of people believing things that are quite obviously not true, things that are quite obviously not aligned with reality. And so it's helpful, I think, for us to remind ourselves of the past, where we've been, and lest we go there again, lest we find ourselves going there again. Hey, every Monday I actually curate a list of news articles and offer a couple of brief reflections on them at my ministry website, which is called reconnectwithcarmen.com. I call it Must Read Monday, and there's no way I can get on Monday to all of the stories that I might want to talk about during this opening segment of Connecting Faith. And so one of the ways that you can see, hey, what's Carmen reading, what's she thinking about what she's reading, would be to go to reconnectwithcarmen.com and check out today's Must Read Monday. The reflections about the anniversary of the Jonestown Massacre are the lead there, but there are also pieces there from Public Discourse and from Missio Alliance and from Christianity Today about evangelism. In fact, two pieces from Ed Stetzer, who is our guest coming up here in just a few minutes. Before we get into our conversation with Ed, I want to highlight something that I read over the weekend from the Missio Alliance, and that's at missioalliance.org. And it caught my eye because it said, for kingdom citizens, civil discourse does not work. And I thought, well, hey, civil discourse is what both Ed Stetzer and Bruce Ashford are actually, and myself, trying to get people to do. And so I better read this if there's somebody out there saying that there's a problem with civil discourse and that Christians need to be doing something other than promoting and provoking and participating in civil discourse. And essentially what this article says is civil discourse is important, but it's not enough. It doesn't go far enough. That the gospel teaches us goes beyond civil discourse to what is described here as neighborly love that disrupts. That we actually have to have, there has to be enough of an edge to what we're saying that it would at some point cut people we love to the heart, right? So it's one thing to participate in civil discourse. It's another thing to actually enter into an inherently prophetic dialogue marked by this self-giving love of the neighbor, sometimes causing offense, sometimes sounding downright uncivil, says the author of this article. And then there's this practical guidance offered, and I would lift that up now because I think this practical guidance is really, really good. What does the posture of neighborly love look like for our world today? And this is the author's few thoughts on this. When we come around the table, again, Thanksgiving is a table holiday, so when we come around a table to dialogue with others, especially those with whom we disagree, and if your table is like mine, there will be people there on Thursday who do not agree with everything that I think and believe. So number one, we don't have to be the first to speak, which means maybe we should be the first to listen. We don't have to have the last word, which means sometimes we can let others have the last word. We don't have to have the loudest voice. Now, that's a good one for me because I tend to speak more loudly than sometimes is necessary. We don't have to win an argument. Remember, what we're trying to win is a person. We're not trying to win an argument. We're trying to win a person. And sometimes being winsome means we're not winning every argument. Jesus often let people walk away, right? We don't know that they didn't circle back around to what he had said. We don't know that they weren't ultimately convinced. We do know that there were times that they simply walked away, and he let them do so. Guided by neighborly self-giving love, this Missio Alliance article says, number one, we can speak with others as fellow or potential members of Christ's body. Now think about that for a moment. If I really consider that everybody that I'm talking to is either a current or potentially future member of the body of Christ with whom I'm going to spend all eternity, then how I approach my conversations might be different. We can give honor and voice to the weakest member among us, which means we don't always have to be the strongest. We can ask questions that reveal desires and fears behind issues. I'm always saying that the issue is always God, so the issue behind the issue is always something about God. The presenting issue is, in fact, not the issue, and the issue is not the person. All right, and then I can speak prophetically by giving witness to how God's reconciliation in Christ challenges the dehumanizing powers and principalities embedded in our personal habits as well as our social structures. The other way that I would say that, more simply, we can speak prophetically by giving witness to how God has actually worked in our own life and how God's work in our life has revealed our own sin and, yes, the sinfulness in the systems of which we are a part. How are you going to enter into the conversations this week? Who do you anticipate being in conversation with? How do you anticipate those conversations going? What are you doing to prepare in advance, prayerfully and thoughtfully, particularly for conversations with those with whom you already know in advance you disagree or they disagree with you? Well, my next conversation here is going to be with Ed Stetzer. He's back to talk with us about his new book, Christians in the Age of Outrage. how to bring our best when the world is at its worst. We just talked with Ed recently here on Connecting Faith a couple of weeks ago, just about things going on in the culture and the need for evangelism. And he's got some great stuff posted today at ChristianityToday.com. Following my conversation with Ed, I'm going to have a conversation with Bruce Ashford. This is actually a re-air of the conversation that I had with Bruce a couple of months ago about his book, Letters to an American Christian. Because the reason I'm re-airing it is because it's really essential for the kinds of conversations we're going to have around the Thanksgiving table this week. All right, friends, you are listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. Up next, a conversation with Ed Stetzer. And then at the bottom of the hour, a re-air of my conversation with Bruce Ashford about his Letters to an American Christian. You're listening to Connecting Faith, and we'll be right back.
Let them see.
Hey friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. Privileged to be joined again today by Ed Stetzer. You know him as the Billy Graham Distinguished Chair of Church Mission and Evangelism at Wheaton College. He also serves there as the Dean of Students of Mission, Ministry, and Leadership. He's the Executive Director of the Billy Graham Center. And today, he and I are going to specifically talk about, we're going to target our conversation to his new book, Christians in the Age of Outrage, How to Bring Our Best When the World is at its Worst. Ed, welcome back to Connecting Faith.
Always good to be here, Carmen. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so, you know, you're like one of my favorite followers or follows on Twitter, so let me just be sure folks know how to find you there. Friends, he's at Ed Stetzer. You can actually, it's fun to engage him on Twitter. Okay, so Ed, this book. I'm going to start with this question. Sort of, you know, there's lots of books out there in the marketplace. Everybody's attempting to speak into the cultural moment. You are doing so from a particular perspective and for a particular purpose. Tell us why.
Well, it's okay. So I'm a conservative evangelical. You know, I'm the interim teaching pastor, for example, at Moody Church in downtown Chicago. So I love the Word of God. I love the faith. I put myself on the conservative side of almost everything. But here's what I find. A lot of my fellow evangelicals are engaging culture poorly right now. They're actually being easily, sometimes easily fooled. They're being, you know, I think about, you know, the opening story in the book is a guy called himself an internet pastor. I'm using air quotes. You can't see them. But I don't know what an internet pastor is, air quotes. Joshua Feierstein, and he actually got going, and everyone upset because Starbucks, well, he said Starbucks hates Christmas because they took Christmas off their cups. A few problems. Number one, Starbucks never had Christmas on their cups. Number two, Starbucks doesn't hate Christmas. Starbucks is a business. It loves coffee. I disagree with the former CEO in some ways. But what happened is his silly video got 17 million views, was a little Christian controversy of the day. Problem was, it was fake and unhelpful and made Christians look foolish. And I got to tell you, I'm deeply concerned that we'd reach people for Jesus, right? I'm sitting right now at the Billy Graham Center. Billy Graham modeled for us a deep compassion for winning people to Christ. People don't want to be part of a movement that is filled with people who are perceived to be easily fooled and angry all the time. And so I think we need a better way. Now, I know Christians like you, Carmen, and Christians I go to church with, and millions of others. But what happens is there seems to be a significant number who are just driven to say incendiary things in social media or to their neighbors and more, and ultimately are not building bridges for the gospel, but instead are actually burning those bridges. So now mind you, some of this directed at Christians as well. I'm actually CNN talked about how I was equally hard on all sides, and I appreciate that because I want to be honest because, yeah, Christians have fake outrage. But at the same time, you know, there's a Christian businessman and well-known Christian businessman. He owns companies that own companies and all that sort of stuff. And an online magazine named Pitchfork actually wrote a story about him. And they said that he gives to because he owns a music festival called Coachella. And his name is Philip Anschutz, by the way. And so Pitchfork magazine writes an article, and quote, here's what it says, Coachella's co-owner, latest charitable filing shows deep anti-LGBTQ ties, unquote. Now, what is the deep LGBTQ ties? Now, Coachella's this music festival, big music festival, and his holding company, he's a billionaire. I don't have any holding companies. So here's the five deep anti-LGBTQ organizations that Pitchfork, which is a music magazine, lists. Here they are. You ready? They're terrible, Carmen. The Navigators, Dare to Share Ministries, shout out to Greg Steer, Center for Urban Renewal and Education, Movie Guide, and worst of all, Young Life. So these are mainstream evangelical Christian organizations. So why say these things? Well, you know, Pitchfork picks up the pitchfork and decides to run that journey. And so here's what it is. It's going both directions. But to quote a politician not that long ago, if we keep kicking each other in the shins, all we're going to end up with is some sore legs and nobody talking to one another. And from a Christian's perspective, man, we can't go to war with a people and reach a people at the same time. So I'm calling for a better way, a gospel-driven way, where we stand up for what's right, what's best for human flourishing. You do that here on the show. And the end result is that we show and share the love of Jesus, not scorch earth those who disagree around us.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, friends, my conversation partner is Ed Stetzer. We're talking specifically today about his book, Christians in the Age of Outrage. I love in the book, Ed, that you don't just expose all the nastiness, although you do that, and you help us see the silos that we are that we find ourselves in. But you really do approach the conversation as a missiologist. You really are seeking to help us understand our cultural moment, our cultural context, and ourselves as, I would say, ambassadors of Jesus Christ. You might say missionaries. Those listening might say, you know, how do I just live as a Christian in the context of the culture? So what's your purpose here? What are you trying to help people navigate?
Well, actually, I do use the word ambassadors. I love the word ambassadors because I think that represents well who we are. This is not our home. And again, we need to speak up and into issues of the day. It matters for our culture. It matters for human flourishing. You know, people vote and will vote and voted so that they can make a difference. And those decisions all have to do because people care. People care about the situations that we're in. Okay, so all that being said, what I really am trying to say is it seems to me that a lot of Christians are indeed going too far. When I go on social media and I see a comment from somebody and the response is some horrible, vitriolic, angry, unchristlike response, I think this must be just a Satanist and whatever. And so I click on it, and it turns out the first line in their bio is Christian. Sometimes it's disciple, or sometimes it's even pastor. And I think you're doing this wrong. And when we're known more for our vitriol, for what we're against, and that's what the media, and I don't know if there's the media, but that's what some people in the media want to show. And there's all kinds of Christians willing to say, yep, we're as bad as you say we are. But when I look historically, I see a different kind of Christian, right? I see, for example, Cyprian in Carthage. There was a plague that hit the city. And what happened is he gathered all the Christians in the middle of town and said, listen, we're going to just care for people, use our resources and means to do it, and regardless of what they believe. You know, a century later, this is early church, a century later, the Christianity is spreading throughout the empire. And one, I recount this in the book, one emperor is really not so happy about it. His name is Julian. He's called Julian the Apostate now. His mother didn't call him that, but Julian the Apostate. And so he writes to his friend. He's trying to stop. They call him the apostate because he's trying to stop the advance of Christianity. And here's what he says, right? A century after Carthage and Cyprian, where they cared for the sick and poor, they kept doing it. And so eventually Julian acknowledges defeat. He writes to a friend in a letter. We have this letter. It says, whilst the pagan priests neglect the poor, the hated Galileans, that's what he called the Christians, the Galileans, I'll go with that, the hated Galileans devote themselves to works of charity. These impious Galileans not only feed their own poor, but ours also, welcoming them into their agape or their love, unquote. And I want us to be those people. Okay, speak up for human flourishing. Yes, we speak up on important issues. Yes, we stand up for religious liberty. Yes, I advocate for life and more. Just spoke at the Chicago March for Life. All those things are true. At the same time, I want us to be known as people who show and share the love of Jesus. And I think we're losing that reputation. People in the media are trying to do that, but we're helping them too much. Let's instead see ourselves as kingdom ambassadors of a foreign land. This is not our home. And let's live as those who represent Jesus, building bridges, not burning them.
All right, friends. So the book is Christians in the Age of Outrage. The author is Ed Stetzer. Encourage you to not only find out more information about the book, but actually like use it to allow yourself to be equipped as an evangelical Christian in the culture today. Ed, you aren't just equipping people through a book. You're also very actively gathering people together in order that we might be more effectively equipped to be like genuinely evangelical Christians. I know you have a passion for evangelism. Why don't you share with folks about the Amplify 2019 North American Evangelism Conference? Because I think that this notion of being preoccupied with love is really an extraordinary calling and makes us very different from others in the culture today.
Well, thank you, and I appreciate you letting me do that. So summer 2019, we now have the largest annual evangelism conference in North America. We gather together, help pastors, church leaders, Christians really seek to engage the culture well. We have a wonderful, diverse lineup of men and women who are going to talk about how to do just that. You know, the writer in the book of Hebrews says, provoke one another to love and good deeds. And that's what we're going to do. We're trying to help people show and share the love of Jesus more effectively, more fruitfully, and more faithfully. And we're doing that by, we have tracks that people be trained, and so it's not just, you know, you go 2 days and basically we teach you how to ask three questions and how to have the answers from the Bible. No, it's going to be how do we engage culture, how do we think about the moment we're in, and much more. So we've found now people have responded, it's growing each year. There'll be over 1,000 people this year. And also, too, we're very excited working with pastors and church leaders. Lilly Foundation gave us a grant to help churches to grow in this, $1 million grant. We think it's the first time they've given a grant with the word evangelism in the name. That's what we're passionate about. And so we're going to be rolling out there some ways churches can get involved at Amplify and beyond in cohorts and more. So we're just committed that Jesus' last words, between his resurrection and his ascension, his last words were four commissions. You know, go and tell and be my witnesses and go to Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and to the othermost parts. We believe Jesus' last earthly words should be our first priority. It seems right now Christians love evangelism. As long as somebody else is doing it, we're instead going to try to help people do it.
All right, we love this. So the conference website, friends, is amplifyconference.tv, amplifyconference.tv. It's at the end of June, June 25th and 26th in 2019. The conference is called Preoccupied with Love. And actually, if you go there to the AmplifyConference.tv website, you can watch the plenary sessions from 2018 and begin not only to whet your appetite, but begin to be equipped to be a genuinely evangelical, Christ-exalting, Christ-minded Christian who, yes, speaks the truth, but does so in love. Ed Stetzer, thank you for everything that you do. Thank you for joining us again today on Connecting Faith, and thank you for the book, Christians in the Age of Outrage.
Appreciate you.
Hey, thanks, man. All right, friends, I got to take one more quick break. When we come back, we'll be making the connecting point. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. You are listening to Connecting Faith. Friends, I'm Carmen LaBerge. You are listening to Connecting Faith. I am joined today by, you know, just frankly, one of my favorite conversation partners in all the world. His name is Bruce Ashford. He wears a lot of hats, including he's the provost and professor of theology and culture at Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary. He has written lots of books. One of my favorites is Every Square Inch, An Introduction to Cultural Engagement for Christians. He also has a book called One Nation Under God, A Christian Hope for American Politics. But what we want to talk about today is his brand new book, Letters to an American Christian. There's probably no way that I could more highly recommend a particular book to you in terms of its timeliness and the way in which it is written. So, again, to whet your appetites, let me read again this passage from page 54 of Letters to an American Christian. We need Christian thinkers who will soak themselves in the biblical narrative and Christian tradition so that they will be able reflexively and intuitively to challenge the reigning narratives of the politicians, parties, and cable news networks so they will counteract the foolishness that dominates our nation's public square and the incivility that degrades our public discourse. Now, there is a lot there. Bruce Ashford, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Carmen, thank you so much for having me on the show. It's a thrill to be back.
Okay, so I feel like what you are saying to us is we got to have, as Christians, we got to be equipped with a little bit more than the Romans road. And we've got to, in order to respond reflexively and intuitively, which, by the way, is language I'm totally stealing, that we got to be people that have the mind of Christ in the matters of the day and are actually walking in step with the Spirit. Is that, from a theological viewpoint, what you're aiming for?
Yes, absolutely. We've got to have this combination of truth and grace that we talk about a lot. Truth without grace makes us a political bully or a jerk. Grace without truth makes us political wimp or a non-entity or an ignoramus. And it's the truth thing that you're focusing in on right now. And I think what we've got to realize is that the Bible, 66 books, numerous authors, many different genres, comes together to form a narrative. It's got a narratival coherence to it. And this story, this narrative, is the true story of the whole world, and it should be the dominant narrative that helps us to interpret the world events of the day. The CNN narrative should not be. MSNBC, Fox, the Republican Party, Democratic narrative per se should not be primary narratives for us. The Bible should be.
I love that. And so, you know, we talk in my family a lot about, you know, are we biblical Christians? Are we, do we have a Christian worldview? Do we have a biblical worldview? We've started using language where we either say we have a gospel worldview or we have a redemptive worldview so that we can get all the parts and pieces in there. And we don't get accused of being like, you know, not doing things that are consistent with maybe what everything in Leviticus. And we don't get accused of being misunderstood. Like if I use the word redemptive worldview, somebody's going to say, what do you mean by that? Like I actually get to define it. And
right.
That's, you know, more times than not, Bruce, that's all I'm looking for in a conversation is the opportunity to define some terms.
Yeah, you're right. I think it gives you a chance to be interesting again, right? Make Christianity interesting again. And one of the ways we can do that is by changing, shifting the categories on people a little bit, reframing issues. I think that's what you're doing, is you're taking language that's ordinary, language that people have used to sort of classify us and then dismiss us after classifying us, and you've changed the terms a little bit and used biblical terms. And this is one of the things we've got to do right now. We've got a very tribalized, polarized environment here in the United States. The political extremes are more crowded than the exit doors at an Al Gore recital. And we've sort of tribalized. We've moved to the hard left and the hard right. And then the way we approach somebody on the other side of the aisle is to take all of the bad attributes that anybody on that side of the aisle has ever exhibited, cluster them all together, and then apply them to each person on the other side of the aisle. And when we do that, you know, Christians, we're seconded by secular political parties and secular movements. We're just like everybody else. We're profoundly uninteresting, and we undermine the gospel. And what you're saying, what I'm saying in Letters to an American Christian, let's be interesting again. Let's let the Christian gospel shape who we are. You know, when we gather on Sunday mornings in a local church, that's actually a deeply political gathering. It's not a Republican gathering or Democrat gathering. It is a gathering where we declare that Jesus is Lord and Caesar is not. Jesus is Lord and Congress is not. And so even the local church gathering on Sunday morning shapes our primary political identity, which is child of the King, gospel-centered person. And then, of course, when the church scatters and we listen to Carmen LaBerge on the radio every morning, we continue to be shaped to be able to think in a more truly Christian manner about the hot-button social and cultural issues of our day.
So, I first of all, I love the book. And, friends, again, it's entitled Letters to an American Christian. Bruce Ashford is the author. And we've got some copies, so you can reach out to us, 877-93-FAITH, or you can email me, carmen@myfaithradio.com. We'll do our best to get you a copy. You can connect with Bruce on Twitter at Bruce Ashford or online, bruceashford.net. In fact, he's got a great thing posted today on populism, like helping us as evangelical Christians understand populism. So encourage you to go to bruceashford.net and check that out. Bruce, one of the things that I think I love about the book the most, man, it's not a very well articulated statement, but is the way that you wrote it. And so just to let folks know, it's actually the series of letters written to this hypothetical college student named Christian. with whom you carry on this correspondence. So I actually love that you're sort of modeling for us in the book how we might go about discipling another person. I'm curious to know, what was the inspiration for this approach?
You know, I've written, I've read a number of books over the years that were written in the form of letters to a person, all right? And what I've noticed is that it's a fun way to write a book, and I think it's a lot of fun to read it. I wrote this book so that people would want to read it at the beach or in an armchair. It's a fun and easy read, but it's got substance. And what I wanted to be able to do is to equip everyday Christians in America to be able to go into a conversation on a social, cultural, political issue, and for us to have something to say and for us to be confident in it, but to be able to be persuasive. I think one of the problems, you know, that we've got in our nation is we've lost the ability to persuade, right? We definitely have the ability to rebuke and mock and insult, but we've got to regain the lost art of persuasion. And it's when you extend the hand of friendship to somebody, you ascribe to them the dignity that they ought to have as a human being created in the image and likeness of God, and we reason with them and try to persuade them. And so this book, that's what it is. It's 26 very short chapters that are written in the form of letters to a college student named Christian who's just become a Christian. He's majoring in political science in an elite progressive university, and he wants to be able to hold his own. So I think it's the kind of book you can give to a college student, also the kind of book you can give to your mom and dad. You know, I think it's written for any American Christian who cares about taking gospel truth and trying to reason from that towards the hot-button political and social and cultural issues of the day. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. The one person I'm not giving it to is my Uncle John.
Yeah, Uncle John might go ballistic.
Uncle John, for listeners, is a character in the book, but Uncle John exists in every American family. He is at every holiday meal. He has very strong opinions. They are not well informed by Scripture, and he is, you know, he's a rough challenge. And I think that Bruce, the way that you deal with Uncle John in the book by equipping Christian to be genuinely full of grace and truth and dealing with him is maybe one of the best little storylines that's sort of under the story of it all. I love the way the whole thing is woven together. We have to take a quick break, but when we come back, I want you to talk about how the goods can become idols. Because you talk about individual freedom, cultural heritage, material prosperity, national and ethnic identity. Those are all goods, but sometimes those goods can become idols. And I want you to just point out, like, precisely how do those manifest as idols today? And then how do we engage in those conversations? Again, friends, you are listening to Connecting Faith. I'm Carmen LaBerge. My conversation partner today is Bruce Ashford. We are talking about Letters to an American Christian. You can follow Bruce on Twitter at Bruce Ashford. You can check out what he's writing at BruceAshford.net. Stick with us right here. We got to take a quick break. I'm Carmen LaBerge. You're listening to Connecting Faith.
Word of God, speak, would you pour down like rain, washing my eyes to see your majesty, to be still and know.
Hey friends, you're listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. I am joined today by Bruce Ashford, and we are talking about, among other things, his latest book, Letters to an American Christian. It is written as a a conversation via letter correspondence with a college student who's a new believer. One of the things I appreciate is that Bruce is not in the book telling this young person how to think. He's actually teaching this, or what to think. He's teaching this young person how to think, and then how to bring that thought life into conversation with the thought life of other people to get other people thinking about not only what they're thinking, but how they're thinking. And so, Bruce, again, thank you for the book, and thank you for being with us here today on Connecting Faith.
Yeah, it's great to be on the show, Carmen. Thank you so much.
So I'm going to draw a little passage from page 53 and then just let you unpack how these goods can become idols. So on page 53, you write, "What I'm trying to do in our letter exchanges is help you approach American politics and public life in a way that resists idolizing any one good. whether that be individual freedom, cultural heritage, material prosperity, or national and ethnic identity. I'm trying to help you construct a political paradigm that recognizes God's sovereignty over our nation, draws on our Christianity to work for the common good, and respects the dignity and rights of citizens who have differing views of the common good. So can you unpack that for us?
Yeah, I'll do my best. So I want to make an analogy between a person's individual personal life and their political and ideologically political life. So on the personal level, the Bible teaches that each of us have a God. All of us, you know, each one of us is a worshiper of some sort. And we might worship the God of Jesus Christ, the Allah of Muhammad, or we might worship sex or money or power. But all of us worship. So if you want to find somebody's true religion, find their God. And if you want to find their God, find what it is that they've made ultimate in their life, what they've ascribed ultimacy to, what they've absolutized, right? And so we know on the personal level it's wrong to make a God out of sex or money or power, because only God the Father, God the Son, and God the Spirit are God, right? But then on the political level, we do the same thing with political ideologies. As we take some aspect of God's good creation, and instead of letting God be sovereign in politics, we let that aspect be sovereign. So, and I want to be an equal opportunity offender here, all right? So if you're out there in radio land and I happen to mention your political ideology first, don't get your hackles up too much. I'm going to be an equal opportunity offender. I'm not prejudiced at all. So take classical liberalism and libertarianism as an example. These are two different ideologies that tend to absolutize liberty. And by liberty, I mean sometimes or often an aberrant view of liberty, which is freedom from all norms, whether those norms are social, moral, or economic. All right? Conservatism, social conservatism, across the years, tends to absolutize cultural heritage. Right? And so it'll rightly want to conserve cultural heritage, but wrongly will elevate it at too high of a level. And what we actually need to do is bring conservatism into an interface with Christianity so that Christianity can help critique the aspects of our cultural heritage that we want to leave behind. Most obvious example in America would be slavery. Progressivism is a modern political ideology that tends to absolutize progress. We'll often take kind of a utopian view of the future and a very jaundiced view of the past, and we'll usually try to overthrow, it's the opposite of conservatism, overthrow the past in order to march onward into a bright new future. And so, but when you absolutize human progress, you don't realize the biblical teaching that we can't bring a utopia, you know, here in this world. Nationalism is the elevation or absolutization either of the nation state or of a privileged ethnic group within the nation state. And as with any other ideology, when you idolize something, when you ascribe ultimacy to it, then it becomes kind of a club that you then use to beat down other good aspects of God's creation. And with nationalism, especially ethno-nationalism, the ethnic nation that has privilege becomes kind of a club that gets to beat down the other ethnic heritages or the other nations. Socialism is the last one, and socialism tends to absolutize material equality, that this is what we're aiming for, is communal ownership and equal amount of material goods for every person. But when you do that, when you absolutize that, you beat down other good aspects of God's world, such as freedom. And so every modern political ideology, we as Christians have got to learn to shape our political views with all of the resources we've got at hand, including Christian scripture, rather than letting ourselves be seconded by our favorite cable news network who wants to give us a secular narrative about the world and would like us to buy it hook, line, and sinker.
Okay, so in all of that, one of the things that I think is critical is that when you say, you know, we're going to bring Christian scripture, and you didn't say it quite this way, but, you know, we're going to apply it to the situations of the day, you are not talking about whipping out one verse and using it to slay somebody. You're talking about soaking ourselves so thoroughly in the biblical narrative and in Christian tradition so that when we're squeezed, what comes out is actually reflexively and intuitively the gospel, the narrative, the big story, the one thing that makes sense of everything.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, one of the worst things we can do is take a hot-button issue in 21st century Democratic Republic, such as the United States, and then think that we can go find one Bible verse that will tell us what we ought to think about a policy issue. The Bible almost never speaks directly to public policy issues in a 21st century democratic republic. It speaks very directly to moral issues, but moral and political are not exactly the same, right? As Christians, we don't believe that we should enact every aspect of Christian morality as the law of the land. Are we going to make it a crime to be proud, you know, and put people in jail? Yeah, you were a little bit arrogant in that conversation the other day. We're going to have to lock you up for the weekend. So political issues are complicated, and we do need to soak ourselves in the scriptures, and we need to listen very carefully to informed voices like your radio show and other radio shows, written opinion outlets, and really read and learn and absorb so that we respond, like we say, intuitively and reflexively on the spot. Our response will be shaped by the Bible's narrative and by the best of Christian thinking, you know, from Christian thinkers who reason from the Bible's narrative towards political issues.
So I appreciate that in Letters to an American Christian, Bruce, you don't shy away from anything. There are chapters on immigration, transgenderism, the proper role of the courts, Black Lives Matter, education, marriage, money, war. I mean, there's so much here. I love chapter 18, and I am going to let you talk with them about shaving a yak.
Yeah, so I've got some fun chapters in this book. You know, chapter 12 of Letters to an American Christian is entitled Nobody Throws a Tantrum Like a Politically Correct American. That's about the politically correct regime. Chapter 18 is entitled To Shave a Yak, which is this chapter addresses environmental issues. And so the chapter argues this, before we get to the yak shaving phrase, that this is God's good world, and we're stewards of it. He's going to return one day to renew it and restore it. And so in the meantime, we ought not to be intentionally trashing it and exploiting it, all right? The Bible does teach that we should cultivate his good world and manage it, but we have to ask, when does that cultivation and management cross the line to exploitation? It's because we don't want to trash God's good world. Then I brought up the example that is the big question everybody's got right now, which is global warming. You know, we're not absolutely sure if the global warming we're seeing is cyclical. It's something that just happens every 100 years, several hundred years, and there's nothing we can do about it. Or if it's human caused, and if it's human caused, we're not dead sure exactly what it is we've done to cause it, or what we could reasonably or practically do to stop it, short of landing all airplanes and parking all cars worldwide, including in India and China. So if it's human caused, and there's not much we can do outside of maybe persuading the entire world to land all the planes and park all the cars, can we do anything at all? And I'd say yes, we can shave yaks. Now, yak shaving comes from an episode of Ren and Stimpy. If you haven't watched Ren and Stimpy, you know it's PG-13, so you have to maybe be a little careful if you like to watch G shows, but it's a cartoon. And there's an episode in which they're shaving yaks. And the whole point of the show is that sometimes you can be doing a fiddly little task, like shaving a yak, that bears no obvious relationship to what you're working on, but by a causal chain, or a chain of causal links, the little task that you're doing helps with the bigger issue at hand. And the example that I gave in the book is, you know, even though none of us can personally stop global warming, if it's something that can be stopped, what we can do is get involved in poverty reduction efforts. That's something all of us can do. And you know what? If more people had been involved in poverty reduction efforts when Katrina hit, the poorer residents, financially challenged residents, would have had the financial means to escape the storm. Almost everybody who died. And all the tragic stories, almost all of them were people who were too poverty-stricken to be able to easily get out of town. So what I'm arguing is we can do what we can do, and we can do that now.
Absolutely. And I really appreciated the way you approached that conversation. I think it's fresh. I think it is. It gives Christians a tangible way to engage in a conversation where otherwise we either, you know, we're either regarded as Luddites or, you know, or we're castigated by, frankly, our own side when we want to talk about creation care and so and issues of justice. So I think that it's superbly well done in terms of helping us find our way in a very complex conversation and do so in a way that's genuinely theocentric, which is, you know, ultimately what we want people to be thinking about. How is it that God would have us, as ambassadors of the kingdom of heaven, approach these issues in the midst of the kingdoms of this world. And that dual citizenry thing is really a lot of what you're talking about in this book. We are citizens of a nation. It's called the United States of America. We are Americans. But you're also writing, you know, expressly to Americans who are Christians. Talk about that citizenry conversation.
Yeah, so that really is the tension, isn't it? That we are ultimately citizens of the heavenly kingdom, right, with Christ as king, and one day he's going to return and install a one-world government with a one-party system, and justice will roll down like the waters. And that's what we have in mind, ultimately, as believers. Anyone who is legitimately a believing Christian is going to have that as the ultimate end. But in the meantime, we are citizens of this kingdom. And when I meet God one day, I will meet him as an American. Now, American is not the most important aspect of my identity. Christian is. But American is a very important aspect of my identity and one for which I will give account. And I think all of us right now are struggling, American Christians, with the fact that the ground has shifted beneath us over the past few decades and not to our advantage. And so some people are kind of pulling away. Some people are spending time seething in resentment. And what we have to do, I think, instead of seething in resentment or withdrawing or charging in angry activism, is to embrace the moment. Listen, Jesus is the cosmic king of the universe, and he was crucified. So if he can deal with that, if he can wander the earth as a homeless, itinerant teacher and then be crucified, certainly we can deal with a little bit of marginalization. So let's embrace the moment. The point of this book, Letters to an American Christian, is to give a series of very easy-to-read, brief chapters that equip Christians to enter into a conversation politically and be interesting and persuasive rather than uninteresting and obnoxious. I think that's what all of us want. Now, I'm not perfect at this, but I've been practicing for a while. And in the book, I'm offering you basically all the practical tips that I can to help strengthen your hand so that we can help make Christianity interesting and compelling again.
Again, friends, the author is Bruce Ashford. You can follow him on Twitter at Bruce Ashford. You can check out what he's writing about a number of subjects at BruceAshford.net, the book we're talking about today, Letters to an American Christian. We've got a few copies, so you can call us at 877-93-FAITH, or you can email me, Carmen@myfaithradio.com. One of the really beautiful things that you do, Bruce, is you encourage readers to actually start writing letters of their own, to actually put this into practice. So first of all, we're not writing hate mail to our pastors or our friends or young Christians or members of Congress or the media. What kind of letters, then, are we writing?
Yeah, so we're writing letters. I'm encouraging people to write a letter, for example, to their pastor, encouraging their pastor for his faithfulness in speaking to public issues. Appropriateness, or writing a letter to a congressman, thanking the congressman for serving our country, and then either encouraging him in a good policy decision he's made, or trying to persuade him to a better point of view. And the point is this: you know, so much of what we've done as believers is hashtag activism, snarky, mocking, condescending, insulting comments by Twitter. We can do so much better than that. Let's jump in there and do something that is a real witness for the Lord. And every Christian can do it. And I hope in the book I've given people an example of how they can get out there and do it.
Hey, friends. I hope you enjoyed those conversations today with Ed Stutzer and with Bruce Ashford. I am Carmen LeBurge. You are listening to Connecting Faith. That conversation with Bruce was a re-air, so we actually don't have additional copies of Letters to an American Christian, but I am going to send mine to the person who already emailed in, so Jennifer in Duluth, there's one headed your way. All right, friends, that's all the time we've got here today on Connecting Faith. Be sure and visit us online, myfaithradio.com. Visit my ministry website, reconnectwithcarmen.com. Grab today's Must Read Monday, and we'll see you right back here tomorrow on Connecting Faith. Have a great day, and God bless. Thanks for listening to this episode of Connecting Faith. These conversations are available because of listener support. Thanks for making a gift now at myfaithradio.com. To catch future editions of Connecting Faith, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend to connect the eternal with the everyday through Connecting Faith.